This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. People working in fast food jobs are the lowest paid workers in the country. If they are lucky enough to get a full-time schedule, they'll make around $18,000 a year, according to the New York Times. Today, we're looking at efforts to unionize those who work at the bottom of the pay scale and whether organized labor can tip the scales to sway employers to take more responsibility for the welfare of their workers. I've got three people with a lot to say about this. Bob Ferrant is a professor in the UMass Lowell Department of History who studies organized labor. Joey DeFrancesco is a Providence labor activist and a former hotel worker. And Marshall Ganz is a legendary labor and political organizer who is a senior lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to you all.
Hi. Thank you. How are you?
Good morning.
So, Joey, I want to start with you because you're most recently in our group of three who been working at one of these jobs in question. So just tell us as a way of context where you worked, how much you earned.
So I worked at the Providence Renaissance Hotel. It's kind of a Marriott sub-brand, and it's very much like working in any of these service jobs. So fast food, retail, like the Walmart jobs that people are talking about a lot. And I made $5.50 an hour. So I made a sub-minimum wage. We were making some tips. The hotel was actually taking a large percentage of our tips, so you're making at or around minimum wage. And as everyone knows, it's pretty much impossible to survive on that. And besides the wages, it's also just a very precarious position. Almost all these jobs are part-time jobs. Your schedule is very erratic. Some weeks I'd work two shifts, other weeks I'd work eight shifts, or working a couple doubles in a week. And so it's just all over the place. And you have little to no job security. You don't know if you're going to have your job in a week because there's an economic downturn and the hotel decides they don't need as many people, or your manager decides they don't like you and they just get rid of you and bring in someone new. So these low-wage jobs, like in fast food, retail, hotels, it's not looking good for people.
Well, there have always been, you know, sort of low-wage jobs. I mean, the fast food workers or whatever. It seems now that these jobs have taken, if you will, a bigger portion of the pie, Bob Ferrant. And that's hence why I think unions have gotten interested in this. But you tell me, is that my imagination, or is that that's what's at stake here?
Not your imagination, sadly. And you see this particularly in the New England states where the rate of growth of inequality is higher in New England, and partly it's because the more well-paying jobs, the kind of jobs that would have been unionized 40, 50, 60 years ago, have been quickly disappearing from the area. Big companies, machinists, clothing workers, all sorts of jobs like that. And so it's not an accident that organized labor is now thinking. I mean, there's a historical parallel to the earlier period in the 20th century when the American Federation of Labor represented what we would have thought of as the skilled trades, and lots of the sort of newer mass production jobs in auto, steel, rubber, things like that were not organized. And a breakaway group from within the American Federation of Labor started up an organizing committee to organize what then were called mass production workers. They would have been food processors, meatpacking plants, things like that. And so this is, to me, when I look at this historically, it fits the pattern of sort of where's the next large group of workers emerging in this redefined economy, just as it was being reshaped in the early 20th century.
And Bob Ferrant, since you do study labor history, is the scenario ripe? I mean, the parallels are there, as you've just said. Those workers were open. Joey just described what was facing him, not much of a future in terms of a living wage. So when those workers started thinking about, well, now how will I improve my scenario, unionizing seemed to be a good move for them. We're not hearing that unions are in a place where they're appreciated at this point in a larger sense. But for those workers, these workers at the bottom of the scale right now, are we seeing some response because of it's reflecting what happened back in history?
I think that you're seeing to some extent you saw in New York a couple of weeks ago, sort of like a flash mob strike almost of lots of McDonald's and other workers in fast food restaurants. And so I think that there's a momentum that will build, again, similar to what happened in the late 20s, early 1930s, where there was, people didn't think those workers were organizable. A lot of people thought those workers can't be organized. and there was a historical upsurge. There was a lot of events and activity. But the difficulty is that a lot of the people that have, a lot of people have tumbled down into these jobs. And so into fast food and things like that from losing one of those better paying jobs. And I think it's going to be tricky to try to figure out how you talk to people and persuade them to take a chance again on unions, because wrongly, I think, but nonetheless, it exists. The story is that you lost your job because of unions. That's not what happened. But so I think that's going to be an interesting thing for organizers to try to figure out as they try to approach this new group of people and try to figure out how do you persuade them that being organized in some way will better your circumstance.
So Marshall Gantz, your work years and years ago with Cesar Chavez and the migrant workers, I mean, you can't get any more low wage than that. At the time when it was revealed to the rest of America, if you will, about what was going on with those workers, there seemed to be a kind of innate sympathy and a feeling that, well, that's not quite American. We want to do something about it. In light of what Bob Ferran has just said, that now we're at a place where people are looking at unions as having caused people to lose their jobs and to tumble down the pay scale. Can unions then find a foothold in organizing these low-wage workers, given the changing, it seems, cultural attitude about unions and their role?
Well, who knows? But I think it'll depend, I think, a great deal on the extent to which they're able to stimulate a movement of the people working in these jobs. I mean, you know, farm work was around as pretty awful work for a long time. Mostly for most of our history, and certainly most of California history, it was done by people of color. It was in the 1930s that briefly it was done by white people during the period written about by John Steinbeck in Grapes of Wrath, that the country noticed that there was such a thing as migrant farm workers. And there was a period of reaction, but as workers. After the war, after the Second World War, sympathy for unions went down, but then there was more support for farm workers organizing as an oppressed minority of color, like in the civil rights movement. In our case, it was mostly Mexican workers that was able to build the support. But it wasn't just sort of sympathy out there. I mean, workers went on strike. They organized for 3 years. They went to cities. They mobilized churches and unions and students to support their efforts through boycotts. So, I mean, this was a very aggressive organizing effort, the heart of which was the commitment of the people themselves to struggle for improving their lives and that of their children. And it's the extent it becomes a moral cause that I think the public responds. And the change won't come without public response and support, I don't think.
Well, and you've said that when the core of good organizing or successful organizing is when those people, as you've just described, fight for themselves, but then when their story and what's going on with them is able to strike something in the rest of the folks outside of their immediate circumstance. And people can look at that and say, hey, you know, this could be me. And I have to say, right now, given what Bob Ferran has said, given what the numbers suggest, where people are falling down into jobs they never thought they would have, it would seem to me that there would be more of a positive response to organizing. But that's not necessarily what's happening. I'm just curious, from your vantage point, as one who's seen this from the long view, can this be the newest beachhead for unions?
Well, it certainly could be. I mean, I think, again, you know, going back to the example of the 1930s, I mean, when workers organized, there was a lot of support because a lot of people were suffering from economic insecurity. And I mean, basically, these organizing drives always come down to question of dignity. And you know, people organize less around low wages than they do offenses to their dignity and their respect. And that's also what most mobilizes other people to support them. And the conditions of work and treatment and character in these low-wage jobs now in fast foods and whatever it is are deeply offensive. And I think that reality needs to be communicated out there through people organizing and being able and willing to take on their employers. That will elicit, I think, the kind of support. It takes public support, though. I mean, Going back again historically in the 30s, one of the things that stimulated the support was John L. Lewis, one of the great union leaders, was able to make an argument that the President of the United States wanted people to join unions through some maneuvering with Franklin Roosevelt. So there's a way in which it's sort of a feedback loop. It's kind of like getting public support elicits more worker engagement, which in turn can elicit more public support and so forth. But it's a kind of movement building that labor leadership needs to understand how to do. It's not like just old NLRB, follow the rules, file for election petition.
That's National Labor Relations Board.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, very good. You got it.
Just so we're all on the same page. All right.
That's right.
Here's some harsh realities, which I'm going to ask Joey to weigh in on again, as one, again, who just had one of these jobs. The five largest increases in inequality are in New England, Connecticut first, then Massachusetts, then New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Vermont. So for people who are thinking, well, these are issues maybe in large urban centers like New York and maybe down south, we're talking about right here in New England, where the gap in terms of what people can make and how they can earn a living wage is huge and getting larger. So back to you, Joey. When you tried, because not only did you work as a low-wage worker, then you tried to unionize, to get your fellow workers to come on board. Describe what that process was like and what kind of response you got.
Well, it's a very, very difficult process. So we worked for years trying to organize our hotel, and we went public eventually. Like, we told the hotel we intended to form a union. We had about 85 to 90% of workers sign up on a public petition in favor of a union, which the city had an agreement with the hotel. That's how we could form a union. It's called a card check. And we presented it to the hotel, and they immediately rejected the petition and began a vicious, vicious union-busting campaign.
And what does that entail? What did that entail?
So it entails a lot of things. They would do some more less nasty things, you know, just like have mandatory meetings. So they make everyone in the hotel go to a meeting. They tell all kinds of made-up lies about unions. They threaten people, say things like they're going to have to lay off half of the hotel if the union gets in. They do even more vicious things, including going so far as firing people. Obviously, they can't just say, hey, we're firing you because you support the union, but they're very clever. They make up things. So, for example, I had a bartender friend who my hotel fired, who was a union leader. They said they were firing her for giving out a free shot of tequila. Now, if you've worked in a bar, if you've ever been to a bar, I had a friend who works there, you know, every bartender in the world does this. And moreover, they had no evidence. They said they had a witness. The cameras over the bar were conveniently down that day. Really, really obvious situation. And this is illegal stuff. But unfortunately, as Marshall mentioned, the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is very, very ineffective. And the penalties to these companies for doing these sorts of things are so tiny that these companies can just consider it an expense, a business expense.
It's like
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because it takes two, if this bartender went to the NLRB and said, hey, this is illegal, maybe in 2 years they'd pick up the case and give the penalty a little bit of fine and possibly reinstate her. In the meantime, the hotel has decimated the union, everyone's demoralized, and so on. So as everyone's saying, we do realize eventually we need new strategies, because this conventional method of unionization is unfortunately ineffective even in the service sector, because the laws are so stacked against us, because these companies are doing such nasty stuff, firing people, having these meetings. I'd have my hours cut all the time. The supervisors are breathing down your neck all the time if you're publicly pro-union. So it's definitely a very, very difficult environment for workers. As it's always been, but especially now, given the economic climate, given the precariousness of these service jobs, it's just very, very difficult to do using conventional methods. So we do have to do these new things, as people have been mentioning, like having these flash strikes, getting publicity. And that's where we see the movement heading, because that's where it needs to head to put pressure on these companies.
Well, Joey, given the fact that, you know, when we talk about the economy, this is very serious business for people who are faced with, well, I'll take a low-wage job or have no job. That's what it comes down to for a lot of people.
Right.
So how do you, what kind of response are you, as a person who's interested in a longer view, in a future strategy that you, because you believe that unionization could help improve worker status, how do you convince somebody who says, hey, Joey, I hear you, but, you know, $5 is $5.
Right. It's a very difficult thing to do because, as I mentioned, these hotels, companies everywhere, they're very good at scaring people. And that's kind of the inside of the company. The outside is just the larger economic climate. It's how do you tell somebody, you know, we need to do this, even though you might lose your job by these people retaliating against you. It's a very, very difficult thing to do, but people are stepping up to do it. Like I said, we had 85-90% of people signed up on these cards. We regularly had tons of people out on the protests, and you're seeing this across the country. People are so desperate, and they're realizing what they're being subjected to, what Marshall was alluding to, right? They're not just the money, but the disrespect that they're seeing every day. Even if they're in this precarious position, they're going to stand up and do something about it. And people are, you know, we're saying, oh, it's such a sad state of unions, but things are going on all over the country. We're seeing these fast food workers, these Walmart workers, hotel workers, casino workers all over the country standing up and doing things in larger numbers than they have in recent years, even though their position is more dire and them getting fired would be even worse for them. You're still seeing them stand up, and that's a very inspiring thing.
We are talking. Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, it was a tough call for farm workers to walk away too, from you know, to risk their employment. But I mean, we learned a couple things. One was that we needed to organize in the community, not just on the job, so that there were bonds connecting people at the community level, whether it was through associations, credit unions, and you know, community organizing stuff. That secondly, rooted in faith traditions that actually helped provide some of the moral energy that it would take to take these kinds of risks. But thirdly, that going on strike in our case, and the farm workers, all that happened is people got replaced by poorer people. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until we discovered that we had to go to the cities and organize boycotts on our employers that we learned that, oh, that opened up a whole new set of tools and tactics that became possible to eventually bring the employers to the bargaining table. And I think it's going to take something like that to engage the public in effective economic action with respect to these employers that can holds the promise of shifting things around.
So Joey mentioned the Walmart Black Friday strike the attempt at several stores. In case people don't know, some of the workers protested being forced now to work the day before Black Friday and also the conditions around which they were going to have to work, and asked people to boycott. You know, from the outside, it didn't seem to be that particularly successful. I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Marshall Gantz, but it would seem to me that from an organizing standpoint, it may be considered successful because these workers stood up and took that risk to begin with. But how would you assess that then as a as an action?
Well, I don't want to, you know, second guess it, but I think it was a first attempt, and I think it was a spark. But it's got to be turned into organized effort. I mean, and I think that's sort of the key thing here, that building these kinds of things is not a question of PR, marketing, or or messaging. In our case, workers went to the cities and lived there and organized people in those cities to picket supermarkets to get them to stop buying grapes. So it was an extension of the whole organizing effort to the whole country and even to other countries. And so it takes investing in building the kind of organized capacity to pull these things off. It doesn't happen just as a messaging thing. That can be a spark, but then the spark's got to achieve the necessary heat. It takes some real, I'm going to lose the metaphor there, but it takes some real building.
I'm speaking with Marshall Gantz. He's a legendary labor and political organizer who's a senior lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Joey DeFrancesca, a Providence labor activist and former hotel worker. And Bob Ferrant, a professor in the UMass Lowell Department of History who studies organized labor. So, Bob, how would you assess the spark of those Walmart workers attempting to get the outside community to boycott Walmart on their behalf?
It's as Marshall just said, I think a beginning step. It's a place to start. And I again, thinking historically, the first efforts in the early 1930s to try to organize an auto and steel or whatever it was were not successful right away. Employers fought back, and in those cases, it was much more violent. But there was, again, it's sort of a cumulative process. And so the same way with the description of the farm workers, that took a long time and the commitment over time. I remember standing in front of grocery stores telling people not to buy a certain kind of lettuce or Gallo wine as part of that process. The same way that in terms of what happened in South Africa, there were boycotts against Shell. People, I still won't pull my car into a Shell gas station. And so I think that there's a certain economic power that can be tapped into in these sorts of struggles. But I think, I mean, from the perspective of organized labor, what I think would need to happen, sort of again in the tradition of what everybody's been saying so far this morning, is the larger unions that want to now turn into thinking about how to organize these workers can't do it, as was already said, the same way that other large workshops are organized, because you don't have 1,000 or 1,500 people in a factory the same way. You can't do that sort of a campaign. But some of these unions that are going to try to put resources into this need to, I think, actually hire some of those workers as the organizers, because those workers, the people from those occupations, are going to be the people that can talk. You can't bring an organizer who used to organize auto workers to try to organize fast food workers. That won't work. And so there has to be a break with that kind of a tradition of organizing from the outside. This needs to come from the inside and from the ground up. And I'm thinking of things like living wage campaigns that we saw a lot. They haven't happened as much lately, but the big struggle at Harvard actually a few years ago around the living wage for janitors and that whole campaign, that was... That grew into something really rich because students got involved, the people in Cambridge got involved, Ben Affleck got involved, right? It became like a big deal. And that's what has to happen with this. It has to sort of mushroom up that way and pull the various constituencies in. It has to get people, we have to make sure, you know, we have to do like boycott Happy Meals or whatever it is, and sort of create that kind of energy the same way that people didn't buy Gallo. We need people in front of McDonald's on Saturday mornings trying to tell people where's the place where you can get better food for your kids and it doesn't exploit the workers. And I think that will then help to mushroom this up from below.
So
one other thing I wanted to add is that in many parts of the country, a lot of the workers are new immigrants, children of new immigrants, a new immigrant community. Suddenly the Latino community has come to the notice of politicians as actually having some political clout, even though a lot of the people working in these jobs may not have documentation. I think there's a whole other overlap there and of the readiness of new immigrants to organize. And traditionally, in the history of the U.S., that's been a major driving force of unionization and organization has been immigration. You know, whether it was the Irish organizing here in New England, or Germans or Slavs or Mexicans or whomever. And I think that's another piece of the puzzle here that I think is an important piece.
So something that is happening, something that has been happening over the years was the outsourcing of jobs, which, of course, left a lot of American workers, you know, with nothing here while they watched their jobs go overseas to workers who, you know, took nothing close to what we would consider a living wage. And then unions also got hit by automation, too, loss of jobs just to machines that could do the work. So it seems to me, Marshall Ganz, that we're facing a larger contextual issue under which all of this unionizing at the bottom, Joey DeFrancesco trying to talk to his people, everything falls. And that is, are we going to be a nation that says better to have a job at a lower wage, because now some of those outsourced jobs are coming back into the country, but at a lower wage, not at the wages that folks used to get paid? Or are we going to push forward and have fewer workers who do have a living wage? It seems to me we're coming to that at this point because of the state of the economy and people feeling as though they can't afford to turn away anything.
Well, I mean, in a sense, it goes to the much bigger question of how, of the imbalance of economic and political power that's put us in this mess, which is what the whole campaign against unions has been all about for the last 40 years, which has been to weaken one of the mainstays of effective democracy has been an organized labor movement. You know, because the whole premise of a functioning democracy is that wealth can be balanced with people somehow. and organized people versus organized money, whether at the firm level, at the community level, at the political level. And unions have been a critical piece of that throughout the developing world. The weakness of unions in the United States is one of the major reasons for all the economic inequality and the bifurcation of jobs into top end and bottom end. And so, in a sense, this issue is about sort of reclaiming our democracy and rebuilding the role of working people and their organizations in our economic life and our political life so that decent jobs are recreated once again. So it seems to me that, you know, starting at the bottom to build back up is as good a place to start as any, but it's the beginning of a much bigger struggle that I think we're beginning to realize in which the whole democracy is at risk.
Marshall Gantz, I know you have to leave us. Thank you so much for joining us for this period of time. Marshall Gantz is a legendary labor and political organizer who is also a senior lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kelly. Take care.
Okay. I'm continuing my conversation with Joey DeFrancesco, who is a Providence labor activist and former hotel worker, and Bob Ferrant, a professor in the UMass Lowell Department of History, who studies organized labor. So let me be the voice of businesses, corporations that who run these fast food or hotels that have workers that have to change the beds or whatever, and they say, you know, some number of these jobs necessarily have to be low wage in order for us to make a profit and to even offer jobs to people. So if you're talking to me about, as the flash mob folks were doing in New York, the flash strike people, they make $7.26 an hour as fast food workers, and they're asking for an increase to 15 with some health insurance. This is okay. How do we survive? How do I offer a product that then is cheap enough so that other people will buy it and I can stay in business? How do you respond to that and say, if I was a different kind of corporation, maybe I can hear you, but I'm not. You know, I'm just down here trying to offer a burger for somebody. Okay, Joey.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that these companies are making tons and tons of money. The trend we've seen in the country is toward these corporations and towards the wealthiest people in the country continue to gain profits, continue to make money, while the people at the bottom are making less and less money, or their wages are stagnant, they're getting less benefits, their jobs are more and more precarious. And so I think this narrative we keep hearing of these companies crying and complaining about, oh, they can't pay anybody anymore, they can't have full-time workers, they can't give people benefits, I think it's just nonsense. And I think if we were going to take seriously this problem of inequality in the country, how we do it is to give more power to these workers. So these companies are going to say that, of course, but I don't think we really believe them, and we don't need to believe them. It's not about convincing them, essentially. I mean, they're not just going to suddenly be nice to us because we have all these workers complaining. It's about creating enough power so that we make them concede to us. And that's what it's about, because that's what companies have been saying for 200 years since factories started popping up in this country, and they're going to continue to say it. But we know the reality of the situation. And if we're going to solve that inequality, these workers, we need to take back that power.
I mean,
Bob?
I think some of the argument is less. The argument on the company would go something like this, and I thought about this the other day when I was watching football, and Papa John's Pizza comes on with Peyton Manning, and they're giving away 2 million pizzas or whatever they're giving away. So amortize that out over the workers that you have and give them a raise instead of giving away 2 million free pizzas. Mm-hmm. So if they can give away 2 million free pizzas. But the other way to think about this, again, is this question of, then who pays? Hmm. Because what happens is workers in these low-wage occupations then sort of fall through the cracks into the social safety net for healthcare, for all sorts of other things that go with a more full-time benefited job. So as a society, we're now on the horns of this dilemma. What kind of society do we want to have? We're arguing now that we can't afford the social safety net. We're also arguing at the same time that we can't afford to give workers a living wage. So, okay, then what are we going to go back to? You know, Charles Dickens in the, you know, late 18th, early 19th century, is that the vision that we want to argue for ourselves? Okay, so here we are. This is basically, we're going to go back to dog-eat-dog capitalism again, survival of the fittest, all that sort of stuff that workers sort of organized in almost intuitively against in the late 19th and the early 20th century. So this is sort of the point made earlier about the role of the faith community and such. This is a role for lots of that population to sort of have this discussion, because we pay, those with a job are paying to subsidize, I think, are paying to subsidize the companies that are keeping wages low and not providing benefits. Unless we want to say, you have a sick child, your child is sick in the middle of the night, needs to go to the hospital, sorry, you can't go because you don't have health insurance. So would we want to have that, again, as this image or what? And so we need...
Or you don't have a sick day.
Or you don't have a sick day, right? Yeah, so yeah. We need that. We have to have that kind of an intelligent conversation at this point. And I mean, I don't think the country's ready for it yet. I don't think we had it during the last election season. It didn't really rise to the level. But I think, again, these larger sort of movements, Occupy put this in front of people in a way that nobody, 3 years ago, if you said we would be having a conversation about the 1% and whatever, nobody would have thought about that. So again, there's a historical wave here that we have to think about.
Well, in addition to the flash strike of the workers in New York, and they're clear about this is a national, they want this to be looked at nationally. Mm-hmm. So these, 200 fast food workers said, we're on strike, we want an increase in the salary and some health insurance and some worker safety issues improved. That's one way of getting attention. The other way, Joey, is something you've been doing with TIP legislation, which you fought for some time ago. That didn't work, and so now you're back. Explain that.
So tip theft, just for people who don't know what that means, it's when managers or companies themselves in restaurants or hotels are actually taking a percentage of workers' tips. So it can happen with like service charges you see on hotel bills. Oftentimes customers think, hey, that's going to the worker, I don't need a tip. It actually goes to the company. Sometimes restaurant managers just dig into workers' pockets right off the bat and take a bunch of it. And this is federally legal. It's illegal in some states, including Massachusetts, but it's legal in Rhode Island. Back in the spring, we were trying to pass state-level legislation, got blocked in the Senate Labor Committee. We'll be back with that. But right now, we're trying to pass it at the city level. And you're seeing similar ordinances being pushed in cities all over the U.S., actually. They passed one in Philadelphia not so long ago. In San Antonio, they're pushing one. Voters in Long Beach, California, actually just passed a referendum on a tip theft ordinance and a living wage ordinance for hotel workers. And this is one of these new strategies we've been talking about, publicity, all these other things. But these new organizations like the fast food, our Walmart, a really good group called Restaurant Opportunity Center that does the same kind of thing with slightly more upscale restaurants, they're using the law, not the NLRB law, National Labor Relations Board law, but local laws, Department of Labor laws, to put pressure on these companies, to get these new ways to put pressure. And for example, Restaurant Opportunity Center has been very successful with that. They've had a campaign against Darden Restaurants. It's this company that owns Red Lobster, Olive Garden, all these other people. They've used publicity to kind of shame these companies, all other kinds of strategies. But they also use the law. They get lawsuits slamming them with discrimination suits, tip theft, wage theft. All of these things, they're directly good because they get that money back in workers' pockets, but they also allow them to pressure these companies. And that's what we're trying to get in Rhode Island. We're trying to stop tip theft. That's good in and of itself, but it also gives unions and other worker organizations this new tool to put pressure on these companies to say, hey, if you're doing this stuff wrong, if you're stealing people's money, we're going to come at you with a lawsuit.
So just to be clear, if I leave money, if I'm in Rhode Island and I leave money in the room for the maid, does somebody takes a chunk of that? Or
it depends largely on the place. A lot of hotels, yes, often cash is the best way to tip because if the worker gets in there first, they're going to pocket that. But in some cases, you are going to have a housekeeping supervisor come in and say, hey, give me, you know, 20% of your tips at the end of the day, or I'm not going to give you a shift next week. Or the hotel itself, with something like credit cards or automatic service charges, a bit easier for them to get into people's pockets. But this stuff's totally legal right now, which is kind of crazy. You kind of intuitively say, hey, that's wrong. But it's legal in a lot of states, and we're trying to end that in Providence through this legislation.
Just as a practical matter, I don't want to harp on this, but if I find the maid and give her the money, is that better than leaving it in the room?
That's probably if you can get cash to the worker, okay. That's usually the best way to do it, because they can put that in their pocket.
All right, because a lot of us, customers don't know that. So you think you're, You know, and also we've been told, Bob Ferrant, that we are depressing the wages. The wages are depressed because we know that people like you come in and tip so that they make up the money in tips. Has this not been said?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, you know, so therefore, really, whatever the minimum wage is really not the minimum wage for workers because they're getting more from tips, but not if, as Joey has just explained to us, half of that's going to some other people who are not even in the room.
And so many workers are excluded from even the minimum wage protections. Back in the 30s, when the minimum wage actually got set up with the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1937, takes effect in 38, but whole groups of workers, whole categories of workers are written out. So housekeepers, domestic workers, most farm workers were excluded. And so we're still sort of in that dilemma where large portions of these sorts of jobs that we're talking about are beyond even the scope of the law. So use the law, yes, where you can, but also recognize lots of people aren't even protected and or covered by it. They fall outside the boundaries of the Fair Labor Standards Act and all sorts of other things. And as well, then, immigrant workers, the point that was made earlier, who comprise a huge portion, if they're, you know, if they don't have their papers or whatever, they can easily be threatened with, just in the example we just gave, oh, you just got $15 tip from someone who left the hotel room, give me 10 of it. What are you going to do about it, right? And so, again, this is all bound up, again, in this sort of larger question, what kind of country do we want to have?
So here's the bottom line. Well, we're hearing about efforts like the tip theft legislation, the movement, the local efforts that Joey and others are a part of, not just in Rhode Island, but, you know, in California and other places. We're hearing about the fast food worker strike. And we're seeing other examples of unions moving in to try to talk to low-wage workers and to some effect. There is a huge anti-union sentiment right now at this moment. This is the lowest level of union membership ever, Bob Ferrant. So is this the wave of the future? Is this a way to return unions to their once respected place? Or how do you see this now? What would you say at this moment that this effort can realize?
I think that, yes, we're potentially on the cusp of a resurgence. Again, in the same way that unions fell to great disfavor, were at a very low ebb in the mid to late 1920s before the Great Depression. And then that cataclysm sort of re-energized people to think again. And I mean, the question, again, that we've been raising this morning, this question of fairness, if unions really sort of grab onto this question of what's fair. I mean, my kids were forever when they were small, whenever I tried doing something. That's not fair, right? I mean, fundamentally, people at some level get that's not fair. And so I think if unions can seize on that and build that community participation that we've been talking about this afternoon as well, yes, the potential is there, but it's, to me, still just potential.
Joey, last word.
Yes, I do think this is the start of something big. If we can keep up the momentum, this is the resurgence of the labor movement in the U.S. And it will only happen if we keep these kinds of new things up. So using these new strategies, using publicity, local laws, reaching out to community groups, targeting new demographics. So the people actually in these jobs, women, people of color, recent immigrants, young people, right? It's about getting this stuff out there to create not this isolated labor movement of these old white guys in back rooms making deals, but creating this movement of labor organizations, of workers' centers, of community groups. And if we can do that, which is, I think, what we have been seeing in this last year, if we can continue to do that, this is the resurgence of that labor movement.
All right. Thank you very much. We've been talking about unionizing the bottom of the pay scale with labor organizer Joey DeFrancesco. You just heard him. And history professor Robert Ferrant, and earlier labor organizer and lecturer Marshall Gantz. Thanks.
Thank you so much.